The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we kick off another week of broadcasting here on KPCG.fm. We have a lot to get to today, including some takeaways from the first round of the presidential election in France. That happened yesterday, and we'll be going to our very own Richard Palmer for some sharp analysis on the events of yesterday in France. Also on today's program, we'll be looking at a Telegraph piece by an Indian author who titled his piece, Britain's Empire was a matter for pride, not guilt, as we Indians know. He's writing in response to some of the modern historians who are, of course, saying that everything about the empire was evil and wrong and so on. So we'll get to his response to that later on in the program. And also, I want to concentrate today on a Wall Street Journal piece that has a headline again that says it all. U.S. farmers who once fed the world are overtaken by new powers. Here, the United States, once the breadbasket of the world, and now the farmers, U.S. farmers, are being overtaken. And there's quite a few prophecies, I know, for many of you that spring to mind just in looking at that Wall Street Journal headline. Well, to begin with, I think I'll start with something a little bit different. I didn't quite get to it today in my Epistles of Paul class, but I had it at the end of my notes, that section in Hebrews 12, the beginning of the 12th chapter, where Paul says, the Apostle Paul writes, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses." This is following the faith chapter, all these witnesses, all of these men and women of faith who died not having received the promises, but who died in faith. And we know that they've obtained a better resurrection because of that faith. And so Paul continues in the 12th chapter saying, "Wherefore, seeing we in the church, those of us today, we're compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses," it says, "let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." Paul was a balanced man. He was, as I've discussed in Epistles of Paul, he really did use a lot of athletic analogies in his writings, including here the track and field analogy, pointing out that baptism just basically gets you out of the starting block, and then you're out onto the race course, and it's like a marathon race, and you have to endure to the end, as Jesus said. You have to run with patience the race that's set before you. He goes on in verse 2, talking about Jesus being the author and the finisher of our faith. We have to look to Jesus Christ. We have to be conditioned, well-conditioned and trained, spiritually speaking, to run and to make it all the way through to the finish line. Well, yesterday here in the UK, they had the London Marathon. And this story, I thought this was great, caught my attention this morning. I didn't see any of the news yesterday regarding the race. But this from the Telegraph, it says, "Self-taught, unknown Josh Griffiths finished as fastest Briton in London Marathon." It says here, "a self-coached student who traveled by London Underground to the starting line produced one of the biggest shocks of recent London Marathon history on Sunday, finishing as the fastest Briton to secure an unlikely place at the World Championships this summer." I mean, this is a very motivated young man from Wales who, he didn't even have that as his goal. He wanted to qualify for a lesser competition, and he gets to the end of the race yesterday, and he ends up qualifying for the World Championships. this young man of just 23 years of age. The Telegraph says here, and this is his first marathon, by the way. Self-taught, trained by himself. It says here, anonymous to most spectators, thanks to the number. His number yesterday was 1154, and so nobody knew who he was. 1154. Unlike the elite runners, whose names adorned their chest, it says Griffiths slowly gained ground on various Olympians and seasoned international runners, passing the overwhelming majority and crossing the line in some disbelief in a time of 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 49 seconds. He finished 13th overall. He was, as it says here, the first Briton, the leading Brit, to cross the finish line. Here's a little bit from Josh Griffith's interview yesterday after the race.
I managed to catch up to the lead British men at about mile 13, but I was working hard with a group of really elite runners, which I've looked up to for a long time. And then, or before I knew it, I started to pull away from some of them. And I was working hard with Robbie Simpson at mile 22. And then I knew that my legs were starting to tire. But at the same time, the crowd was amazing and carried me to the finish line. And I didn't really realise until I crossed the line where I'd just done.
Was there a point at which you knew that you were the lead British runner?
I would say mile 25, I started to think, yeah, I'm pretty sure I passed everybody, but you're never really sure until you cross that line.
And he crossed it. He sure did, setting a record for himself, going faster than he even trained or hoped that he would during training. And as I say, it's a great inspirational story to see a nobody actually shock the world. I mean, God's really doing his work today through a collection of nobodies. And as Paul says there in Hebrews 12, we've really got to run and run the race with patience. We've got to stay on the course. We've got to keep on keeping on. And perhaps draw a little inspiration from not only what Paul said in Hebrews 12, but from stories like this one yesterday from London. Well, as you know, we talked about it last week at length, the first round of the presidential election in France, coming down to these two, Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen. And these two basically came out on top, and all of the establishment groups took a hit yesterday, and now it's down to these two, a seismic shift, as one journal put it, a seismic shift in French politics. The conservative, François Fillon, he didn't win. The far leftists, he didn't make it. But you have, as Richard Palmer discusses in this short video that we, it's probably posted at the website right now, in fact. You can go to thetrumpet.com if you'd like to hear this again. But we'll go ahead and play the audio from this video that we've prepared. We'll play the audio in its entirety. And Richard, as he often does when he's analyzing news coming out of Europe, he's well-read when it comes to this part of the world. And here in this clip, he gives you some takeaways from the French election.
The first round of France's election is over. As expected, nobody won more than 50% of the vote. And that means the top two candidates go for a runoff election scheduled now for May 7th. And as expected, those top two candidates are the centralist Emmanuel Macron and the far-right National Front leader Marine Le Pen. And I think there's three things we can take away from yesterday's election in France. The first is don't rule Le Pen out yet. The general consensus is that this is in the bag now for Emmanuel Macron. Typically in France, the left and the right wing ally to block the National Front. And I do agree that Macron does seem like the probable victor, but this is still an unusual election. Macron, he's generally inoffensive, but nobody's really enthusiastic about him. 30% of pollsters, or 30% have told pollsters that they would stay at home in this kind of a situation. So we're facing historically low turnout, But at the same time, Le Pen has very motivated and eager supporters. Will this be enough to tip the balance? Personally, I don't think so, but I wouldn't rule out a Le Pen victory either. Now, the second takeaway from yesterday's elections is that the winner is going to be a lame duck. François Hollande, the current president, is the most unpopular leader in French history. His approval ratings have sunk as low as 4% in some surveys. Now, Macron in many ways is similar to Hollande and could well share exactly the same fate. More practically, France holds parliamentary elections scheduled for June 10th. Now, Emmanuel Macron used to be in Hollande's party. He quit because of its extreme unpopularity. He founded his own brand new party about a year ago. And there's no way this new party can go from nothing to a majority in a year. Instead, the victor of this parliamentary election is expected to be François Fillon's Conservative Party. So right from the start, Macron is going to have Parliament against him. It's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for a very weak France. France, as it is, has huge problems with radical Islam, with its economy. Youth unemployment is at 25%. And now it looks like there's going to be political deadlock and nobody's going to be able to get anything done. And that then leads to my final and most important point is that a lot of French are very angry. 47%, nearly half of French voters yesterday voted for parties that basically want France out of the euro. Almost half of French, they voted for what just a few years ago would have been extreme minority positions. That's a stunning result. And that is not going away. If anything, given what we've just talked about, that's just going to rise and get worse over the next few years. So if Macron wins, I think the world's going to breathe a sigh of relief. You'll see lots of newspaper articles talking about how he just dodged a bullet. But this story, this trend is a whole lot bigger than one election in one or two countries. Europeans as a whole are very dissatisfied with their political system. They're incredibly dissatisfied with their economic system. And the percentage that wants radical change is getting closer and closer to being a majority now. And so that means major, major changes are ahead for Europe.
That is the Trumpet.com's Richard Palmer that you often hear on Trumpet Hour. He fills in for me quite often on this program as well, giving you the takeaways from yesterday's election in France. There's so many Europeans who are dissatisfied. And as we said last week, I mean, we don't know exactly how some of these elections are going to unfold. But you can see just from the changes in the last few years, there's going to be massive changes in France and all of Europe. And these kinds of elections show what's coming. France has rejected mainstream. That's the way the Associated Press put it. The mainstream is rejected. And again, a lot of the headlines are saying they're going to the mainstream will unite now behind Macron over Le Pen. But you, as Richard pointed out there, you can't necessarily rule out Le Pen just because of what everyone's forecasting. But even if Macron gets in, how much will he be able to get accomplished politically, given that his political party just started less than a year ago? The Telegraph here says this news, the fact that Macron's probably going to come through, it will have been greeted with glee in Brussels, where Mr. Macron, who is predicted by those same pollsters to win by a comfortable 20-point margin in 2 weeks' time, is seen as a potential savior of their troubled union. So the EU is going to greet this with applause, no doubt. And that could, going in that direction could be significant too for the EU project. This Telegraph piece says, with his pledge to strengthen EU external borders with a 5,000 strong force, maintain the Schengen free travel zone, and appoint a finance minister for the Eurozone, Mr. Macron has pledged to start a rebirth of the European project. And so all are pretty much in agreement that with Britain on the way out in particular. And given the immigration crisis and so on, and these continuing terrorist attacks as we covered last week, Europe needs to be reborn. Europe, the European project needs to be revised. And as you know, Bible prophecy says that it will be, and soon. It talks about the obstacles, though, that Macron is facing, not least of which is, of course, Marine Le Pen. Even if she's unlikely to win at this point, the influence that she's had and that her supporters have had on France and on all of Europe, it's undeniable. So it's certainly something that we'll be watching. I guess the runoff would be in 2 weeks, so we'll know pretty soon how it's going to shake down politically in France. Well, a couple more stories here before we break away for a moment. These are two stories I've been meaning to get to now for a week or two, and they tie in, and I think they'll be a good tie-in to the next segment, that Wall Street Journal piece that I want to draw your attention to about the United States, how it used to feed the world, but now that's changing. It's really changed dramatically in recent years. But this first one here, a census study on Americans, more adults, young adults, 18 to 34, now live with their parents than they do with a spouse. 18 to 34, there's more of them in the United States living with parents than with a spouse. They're not married. They're living at home with mom and dad, which for an 18-year-old, that's one thing. But 34, 31, 32, 33? Bloomberg has another piece here. Young Americans are killing marriage. Notice this. It says the National Center for Family and Marriage Research at Bowling Green State University set out to compare 25 to 34-year-olds in 1980, or baby boomers, with the same group today. The results, it says, reveal some stark differences in how young Americans are living today compared with three or four decades ago. In 1980, two-thirds of 25 to 34-year-olds were already married, so it was very different. Back when young people would marry when they're young, much more so than today. Mr. Armstrong, in his wonderful booklet, Why Marriage? Soon Obsolete? Here again, writing in the 50s or 60s, he's spot on. He's way ahead of his time. Talking about the obsolescence of marriage as an institution. The only ones fighting for it, it would seem, are those in the homosexual community. But not in this group. It says 1 in 8 had already been married and divorced. It says in 2015, just 2 in 5 millennials were married, and only 7% had been divorced. Further on, baby boomers' eagerness to get married meant that they were far more likely than today's young people to live on their own. It says down further, the chance that Americans in their late 20s and early 30s live with parents or grandparents has more than doubled. In 1980, just 9% of 25 to 34-year-olds were doing so. In 2015, 22% lived with parents or grandparents. It's easy, it says, it's easy to look at these figures and say millennials are lagging behind their boomer parents. However, notice how it concludes here. However, even as young Americans delay marriage, kids, and home ownership, they're ahead of their parents by one measure, education. That's how it concludes. I mean, we're more educated today. At least, you know, they may be living at home, they may be putting off marriage, they may not have children yet, but they're really educated. Oh, yes, they are. And isn't it amazing that the more educated we are, and I put educated in quotes, the worse the family gets. We're seeing a breakdown in family in the United States and here in Britain as well. And yet, oh, how sophisticated and educated we are. What a paradox, as Herbert Armstrong so often said. The more and more educated we become, the further we drift away from our Maker, away from our God. When we come back, I'll look into this Wall Street Journal piece from, I think, from last week. U.S. farmers who once fed the world are overtaken by new powers. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
You know, in so many of these stories that you see, like we touched on at the end of the last segment, the decline of marriage, young Americans killing marriage, and then this one here from the Wall Street Journal, U.S. farmers who once fed the world are overtaken by new powers and missing from all these kinds of pieces is God. I mean, where is God in any of this? In the case of the breadbasket one, they talk about market forces this and trade barriers and, well, there's cheap land in Brazil and this factors in. But nowhere is it even mentioned. The blessings that came from God, and it wasn't that long ago, that it was just generally acknowledged that we had all of this wealth, this prosperity, this fruitful abundance because of God's blessing. And of course, home life and family, the traditional family was seen as a huge blessing as well for all parties, husbands, wives, children, for the community. It was the foundational building block of civilization. And now it's all breaking down, and yet still the major media is there to point out, well, you know, but we are educated. We're a lot more educated than our forefathers. That's one positive you can take away from this. How educated are we? Hosea 4 and verse 6 says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." I mean, where is the right knowledge? Where is their truth in this era of fake news, of lies and rumors and gossip? We once fed the world, but now we've been overtaken by new powers. That's interesting language, isn't it? Because in Leviticus 26, it says, if you disobey your God, you're going to be overtaken by curses. That's the way God sees it. And that's the way we should see it. This is basic. I mean, this is fundamental. Blessings and cursings. Cause and effect. Blessed for obedience. Cursed for disobedience and sin. It's right there in Deuteronomy. It's there in Leviticus. It's a basic principle of the Holy Scriptures. In the Wall Street Journal, it says here, on a pancake flat stretch of land not far from the Mississippi River, Illinois farmer Jerry Gaffner thumbs through weather forecasts and crop reports in his tablet computer, searching for clues about when to market his soybean crop. The data streaming in isn't from Illinois or even from the American Midwest. It's from half a world away in Brazil, where farmers are harvesting what's expected to be a record soybean crop. With 43% of the export market, up from just 12% 30 years ago, Brazil can sway global prices with the weather hiccup or transportation snarl, spurring U.S. farmers to sell crops and capture profits or to bunker grain and hold off until prices improve. There's U.S. farmers. Farmers who once fed the world, and now there's these new powers that are overtaking them. It says Mr. Gaffner pays close attention to South American conditions because of the new reality facing U.S. farmers. America's agricultural dominance has eroded. And so here again, we come back to the writings of Herbert W. Armstrong, writing back in the 1950s, even back in the 1940s, even back into the 1930s. Writing way ahead of his time. Why? How do we get all these blessings? And added to that, why are they being taken away? This article points out how Brazil overtook us as the biggest soybean exporter just 5 years ago. It says Russia now beats America in shipments of wheat. Can you imagine that? So much for the bread basket. Russia is now ahead of the United States when it comes to shipments of wheat. Well, listen to the way the Wall Street Journal puts it. It's a reversal for a country that has long identified as the world's breadbasket. America's share of global corn, soybean, and wheat exports has shrunk by more than half since the mid-1970s. In soybeans, the most exported U.S. crop, U.S. supplies make up about 40% of the world's exports, down from more than 70% 3 decades ago. You think about all of those statistics in the United States and Britain in prophecy. The birthright at its zenith, Mr. Armstrong would say. Here's what it was when we were right at our peak. All of these blessings, I mean, just overtaken by blessings because of promises God made to Abraham for his obedience. Cause and effect. Blessings for obedience. Says here, other countries' rising share of global trade and their bin-busting harvests have helped fuel a multi-year downturn in crop prices that is pushing some U.S. farmers out of business. This is the United States. Agriculture in the United States that we're talking about here. That blessed land. American farmers' fates are inextricably tied to the broader economy. Agriculture is among the few U.S. industries that exports more goods than it imports, helping to narrow the nation's overall trade deficit. I mean, we need this. There's a massive trade deficit. And so surely we can count on American farmers to send out more than we're taking in. Well, that, like so many other areas, so many other trends, it's going in the wrong direction. U.S. taxpayers are tied to farming through the billions spent each year by the government to help insure farmers against crop shortfalls or lost income. And that's another angle of this story as well. The huge subsidies coming from the U.S. government just to keep everything afloat, just to keep everything working, just to keep all the farmers in business. It says here for the 12 years ending in 2027, the USDA is expected to spend nearly $87 billion to help protect farmers. That's according to the CBO. Anxiety over the U.S. role in agricultural trade has grown in recent months amid moves by President Donald Trump to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was backed by many farm groups, and potential changes to the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, in other words. which they say helped develop exports to Canada and Mexico. And so, like you've been reading perhaps even recently about some of the benefits companies like Carrier and others that the Trump administration has fought for, others haven't benefited quite so much. One U.S. company benefits and another suffers. And more important than that is the fact that it's leading to trade war. Trade war that's going to freeze out the United States. We've talked about that at length on this program. It says here, Russia over the past decade boosted its wheat harvest by 61%. Corn acreage has nearly tripled in Russia and more than doubled in Ukraine. Brazil and Argentina have also ramped up output of the grain. Foreign farm powers in South America and Eastern Europe owe some of their grain market victories to favorable exchange rates, so they're benefiting from the strong dollar as well. It says other countries have structured trade policy to benefit their farm sectors and have invested in infrastructure such as barge terminals and railroad networks to cut transport costs. I mean, these were all the things that 100 years ago that had the United States of America light years ahead of every other country. But now all the other countries are catching up or passing us. Think about that program I gave, last summer when we visited the Coventry Transport Museum. Just about the industrial power and might of the United States and Britain. Or in the case of the Transport Museum, the British automotive industry, which is all but dead today. But there was a time, boy, when you go back to the peak of our power, nobody could match up to the power, might, and wealth and prosperity of the United States and Britain. Well, this article goes on to talk about Brazil and the advances they're making down there, taking advantage of cheap land and of course, soil treatments and GMOs and things of that nature that are worsening the health of all of us in this world. But they're able to, because of the cheap land and the favorable climate, they're able to have one crop right after another. And U.S. farmers are finding it harder and harder to compete. It says here, finally, income in the U.S. farm sector will decline for the fourth year this year, falling to $62.3 billion, half of what it was in 2013. How about that for a trend? For a five-year trend? It says overall, U.S. farmland has shrunk by 12%, or 46 million acres, since 1982, partly due to urban development. In contrast, it says in Brazil, about 150 million more acres in the Cerrado could eventually come under the plow as farmers convert more pasture into fields for crops. You look at the direction in Brazil, in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, in Russia. And then consider what's happening in what was the breadbasket of the world. Notice what it says in Deuteronomy 33. This is verse 13. Mr. Armstrong writes about this in The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Moses wrote, and of Joseph he said, Joseph, blessed of the Lord be his land. Blessed be his land, Joseph and his descendants, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that couches beneath. Bless his land. And did God ever do that? And you still see the carryover from it today. Even as we travel around this small island that once presided over how much of the world? A fourth or a third of the world when the British Empire was at its peak. But even here on this little island, the beauty, the wealth, the prosperity, and then you take the United States, you multiply here by many times over, and the United States has a little bit of everything. The choicest piece of land on earth. And of Joseph, he said, blessed of the Lord be his land. His land would be blessed. Verse 14 says, and for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things put forth by the moon, and for the chief things of the ancient mountains, and for the precious things of the lasting hills, and for the precious things of the earth and fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush, let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph. The head is Ephraim and Manasseh, the birthright peoples, the United States and Britain. Mr. Armstrong said in the U.S. and Britain in prophecy, whoever is Ephraim and Manasseh today must have been in possession of the earth's choicest agricultural, mineral, and other wealth. I mean, it must be our peoples. Just look at how fabulously wealthy they've become, or they were. Continuing in that verse, verse 16 of Deuteronomy 33, blessing come upon the head of Joseph, that's Ephraim and Manasseh, and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. Back to U.S. and Britain in prophecy, Mr. Armstrong said, this is on page 156 of the book that we've printed. If you have a copy at home, you can look at this later. Mr. Armstrong said, more than half of all tillable, cultivatable, temperate zone lands of this earth came after AD 1800 into the possession of our two great powers alone. More than half of the tillable, cultivatable, temperate zone lands of the earth. We acquired these lands. God gave them to us. It says the rich agricultural lands of the Mississippi Valley, the vast wheat and grain fields of the Midwest, of Canada and Australia, the great forest lands of the Pacific Northwest and many other parts of the world, the gold fields of South Africa, Australia, Alaska, and the United States, the great coal mines of the United States and the British Isles, the natural waterfalls and means of power and consequent prosperous industrial and manufacturing districts of England and the eastern United States, the choicest fruit lands of our Pacific coast and Florida. What other nations combined ever possessed such material wealth? Who else is it? If it's not our peoples who are the descendants of Joseph, who else could it be? Deuteronomy 33 and verse 17 says, his glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horn, his horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth. And they are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. How did we come upon all of this fabulous wealth? Half of the world's tillable, cultivatable, temperate zone lands. Did we acquire all of this because of our own ingenuity and wisdom, foresight, our own energy, ability, or power? Well, as I said, you don't have to go that far back in our own history. When all politicians concluded that these came upon us because of God, because we've been blessed by God. Abraham Lincoln said, we find ourselves in the peaceful possession of the fairest portion of the earth. As regards fertility of soil, extent of territory, and salubrity of climate, we find ourselves the legal inheritors of these fundamental blessings. We toiled not in the acquirement or the establishment of them. We didn't come upon this of our own strength or power. God gave us this land. God gave us these blessings. He said further, this is from a separate speech in 1863, it's the duty of nations as well as of men to own their dependence upon the overruling power of God and to recognize the sublime truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. Where do the blessings come from? The blessings of family, the blessings of all of these cultivatable temperate zone lands, the blessings of good weather, rain in due season, comes from God. He said, this is Abraham Lincoln, we've been the recipients of the choicest blessings of heaven. We've been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We've grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation ever has grown. And then he said, but we have forgotten God. That's Abraham Lincoln. That's what he concluded in 1863. We've forgotten God. We've forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. We vainly imagined that we brought all this on ourselves. And now, well, there's just, you know, some market forces are making it difficult for our farmers. We're being overtaken by new powers. But what does the Bible say? Well, we read Deuteronomy 33. Read Leviticus 26. It's been called the blessings and cursings chapter. And early on in that passage, it's verses 3 and 4, God promises rain in due season and bountiful crops. That's what he promises for our obedience. He says, if you obey my laws, then you will be blessed. You will have bountiful harvests. Let me just read that to you. This is Leviticus 26, verse 3. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage shall reach unto the sowing time, and you shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land safely. And I'll give peace in the land, and you'll lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And on and on and on it goes. God says, I'll make you fruitful. You shall eat old store and bring forth the old because of the new. I'll walk among you, he says, and will be your God, and you'll be my people. But then you continue reading in the same passage, down around verse 18, Leviticus 26, 18. I'll read from Moffat. It says, If even then you will not listen to me, I will punish you seven times more for your sins. I'll break the power of which you are so proud. I'll make the sky hard as iron for you and the earth hard as bronze till you spend your strength in vain. For your land, it says, shall bear no crops, and your trees shall bear no fruit. Here, America, I mean, it's been called the land of opportunity. It's been called the breadbasket of the world. Where else, even today, can you find such an abundance of fertile farmland and a climate so perfectly suited for fruitful abundance. And yet, well, there's new forces, new powers at work here. And our U.S. farmers, who once fed the world, they're being overtaken. They're being overtaken. Amos 4, look at what the prophet Amos has to say, again, about these curses setting in. I mean, God truly has showered our people with so much wealth and prosperity. But that's the thing, isn't it? God is the one who gave it to us. And now, because of our many sins and transgressions, we're seeing them taken away. We're seeing them taken away. Amos 4 and verse 7 says, And also I have withholden the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered. So two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Yet have you not returned unto me, says the Eternal. This is what God wants. He wants for us to return to Him. He reveals here in Leviticus 26, in Amos 4, as we just read, that there certainly is a connection between how we live and the fruitful abundance of the field, or lack thereof. Lincoln said that we've forgotten God. And that was in 1863. Today, you look around, you see a people so deeply entrenched in the way of sin and selfishness and vanity. And God's trying to wake us up. He says, for the individual or the collective, if you turn to me and keep the commandments, then I'll bless you and I'll give you divine protection when the disaster strikes. This morning in class, because we were going through Hebrews 11, we looked at that example with Noah there in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Well, I guess we can go over there and look at it. I see at the clock that we probably won't have time for the other segment I had in mind on the British Empire. Ties right in with what we're talking about here. Maybe I can get into that further on tomorrow's broadcast. But here in the faith chapter, Hebrews 11, and God says that without faith, it's impossible to please Him. If we come to God, we've got to believe. What kind of belief are you talking about? The kind of belief or the kind of faith of these towering figures in Hebrews 11. Like Noah, for example. It says, by faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear. You see, Noah moved with fear. God told him what was coming, and he acted. It says he prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. By faith, Noah, he was warned. First, God warned him. And then because he acted, because he feared God, God used the Noah work to warn the world. Ours is a work very similar to that. God's work today. Everything that you see the work of God today, building up and constructing, distributing and disseminating, it's there like the ark of old. The building itself, the structures themselves, whether physical or spiritual, you look at the work God's raising up. This is the very beginning of the wonderful world tomorrow, and it serves as a witness as an example today. It's a warning, in fact. Noah prepared an ark to the saving of his house. His own personal family was spared or saved or protected from the disaster that struck. But as I was bringing out this morning in class, here was Noah building this ark, this massive floating ark, at a time when there was no flood. It went on for 100 years. Imagine if Noah was like the everyday Protestant of today, who just believes on Christ but doesn't do anything with it. What if when God warned Noah, Noah said, "Well, I believe you. That sounds great. Build an ark for 100 years. Well, I'm not going to do that. I mean, come on. I'll be ridiculed. I'll be laughed at. I'll be mocked. And furthermore, I don't even see any clouds forming. 100 years? What would the average human being have done 7, 8 years into that project, or at year 26 or year 47? But it says here that Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, he didn't see them physically with the five senses. He didn't see any evidence that an earth-wide flood was coming, but God said it was coming. And he was moved with fear, the Bible says. He prepared an ark for the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world. That construction project, as it turns out, it condemned the world. It warned the world. Noah's example warned the world as well. And that's what we see with examples like his. Noah before the flood, or Lot, when God was about to rain down fire from heaven upon Sodom. Or the Israelites, when God intervened to bring them out of captivity. And all of those plagues that struck the Egyptians. And yet God spared Israel. He spared those who followed his instructions. You select a lamb. You scrutinize this lamb. Make sure it's without spot or blemish. And then sacrifice the lamb at the start of the 14th and smear the blood over the doorpost. And in the middle of the night, the death angel will see the blood and pass over. They were saved by the blood. Only God can save us, which is why we better be walking by faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. He that comes to God must believe that he is, it says in verse 6, and that he's a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. You see that? Blessings, rewards, benefits. If we obey God, if we walk by faith, if we diligently seek him, our maker, God says there will be rewards, there will be blessings. The same principle applies today to you, the individual. Even as we see our nations not seeking God, even as we see our nations suffering because of curses, there is hope for you. The individual listening to this broadcast, if we turn to God in humble repentance and then diligently seek after him, God will reward you. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.